My name is Gary. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date's May 17th, 1995, and my home group is Knuckleheads Men's Group. Meets here in Portland on Thursday nights. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for asking me to do this. I feel really honored to be asked to do something like this. And yeah, so I'll just jump right in. I was asked to speak about sponsorship tonight, and so figured I probably better do that. And I'll just start off with kind of the thing. I always want to find something really cool to read about sponsorship in the book, but I always end up falling back on this. First sentence in the chapter, Working with Others, practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. And I found that to be true in my own life, in my own recovery. That has been the most constant thing in my recovery in terms of my having a sponsor and sponsoring others. And it's been the thing that's really saved my butt over and over and over again. I think that working in a program in Alcoholics Anonymous is a package deal. You know, there are meetings, and there's the step work, and there are the traditions, and there's the fellowship, and there's a lot of things that we have to do around here. There's a guy in my home group that says, you know, if there was only one thing, if I could figure out just which things I had to do to stay sober, I would just pick those things and just do those things, because I don't want to have to do any more than is necessary to stay sober. So he says, the problem is I can't figure it out, so I just do all of it, and hopefully I got all my bases covered. And I relate to that. And it is a package deal. And I, for myself, I guess I'm just one of those people who has to kind of do a little bit of all of it. And had it been left up to me, I would have taken a book. I'm good with books. I like books. I would have taken the book, and I would have gone off into a corner, and I would have just done it myself. I don't want your help. Thank you very much. Unfortunately, that didn't really work for me. In fact, I tried that, as a matter of fact. And I tried that and just not drinking for about a year. And the end result of that was that I came to mid-May, in a mental institution. And having no idea how I got there, turned out it was a drug overdose. And prior to that, you know, I had spent as many years as I possibly could drinking as much alcohol as I possibly could, doing as many drugs as I possibly could, doing anything I possibly could to change the way that I felt, because I couldn't stand the way that I felt. And I ran that one into the ground. And I eventually made my way to AA, or was invited very nicely by judges and some other people to come to AA, and tried the just not drinking for a year thing. And the one thing I just could not bring myself to do, or would not bring myself to do, was reach out and ask somebody for help. So I wake up in this mental institution, this mental ward of this hospital, and there were visitors, strangely. I mean, people other than my family and a good buddy of mine who came by. And one guy in particular, whose name was Greg, although I couldn't remember that at the time. I had to sort of reintroduce myself to him, because I'd seen the guy around meetings for the previous year. And he was one of these handshakers. You know, he always had his shaking his people's hands, and he had this big, huge, you know, hoopty station wagon thing, the 1978 station wagon thing that he would was always piling people in meeting after meetings and taking them out to coffee and stuff. And so I'd known the guy from around, but I didn't really know him that well. He didn't know me anything. I'd never really spoken to him except when he came up to me and shook my hand and, hey, Gary, how you doing? Good to see you. And here he was in this hospital. And I remember, you know, I was a little spaced out. I'd been in a coma, and I was in real bad shape. So I had to kind of be, you know, I was like, I know I should know who you are, but I really don't. I'm sorry. And he looked at me and he smiled and he said, my name is Greg. And he put his hand out to me. And when he smiled, you know, his eyes sort of smiled along with his face, and he had this sort of sparkly eye thing going on. And it was very attractive. And we talked for a while. I could not tell you what we talked about, but I know we talked for some time, and then he left. And after I got out of that hospital, I went back to AA because I had no place else to go. And shortly after that, I heard the same guy speak in a meeting. He was the speaker in a situation like this, but much smaller. And he talked about alcoholism and recovery from alcoholism in a way that I could hear what he was saying. And I thought to myself, man, here's somebody who understands the kind of fear that I understand. Here's somebody who understands the kind of insanity that I understand. And I think that if you're looking for a sponsor, there are tons of great suggestions out there about, you know, find somebody who's got what you want, find somebody who's got what they want, which I think is actually better. My sponsor's a landscape guy. He's got his own business. Guy goes to college, gets a couple degrees, becomes the head of some school someplace, and decides to forget that, and he became a landscape. He owns his own business. He's a landscaper. Guy, literally, he mows people's lawns. I have no desire whatsoever to mow. I don't even have a lawn. And I have no desire whatsoever to be a landscaper. He's a smart guy, but he doesn't want to have a boss, and it's what he likes. He's never been happier. And here's a man who's been able to create in his life what he wants in his life, and I want that. That's attractive to me. But anyway, there are a lot of great suggestions out there about what to look for in a sponsor. What it came down to for me was this guy was speaking my language. I could hear this guy. And you know how it is. If you have a problem or you have an issue in the program or wherever in life, you go to 10 different people and you might get 10 slightly different answers, maybe fundamentally the same, but everybody puts it just a little bit differently. And eventually you'll come to that person that'll put it in just such a way, might be saying the same thing, but just will put it in that way where you go, oh, okay, I get it. And that's for me is what my sponsor is and does for me. I don't have a whole lot of time here. Boy, you know, I'm realizing now that I've gotten started, I could talk about this for probably a very long time. So rather than doing that, I'll just kind of not. What would I, you know, the essential thing, what would I want to say about sponsorship? I think, you know, when it comes to what I read in the book about nothing is better insurance against drinking except intensive work with other alcoholics, I think sponsorship is really the primary and the most direct way that we do that in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's been the case for me. It's a unique relationship in my life. My sponsor is not like my father. He's not like my brother. He's not like my buddy. He's my sponsor. And I've been able to find that with him, and I've tried to do my part to create that with the guys that I work with. I don't really have fulfill other roles in their lives. I'm the guy that they come to when they have a question about how to take steps, how to implement the program of Alcoholics Anonymous into their lives. And I try to encourage them to use me for that. My sponsor did basically two essential things. He showed me how to work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was important. And I think probably in a perfect world, that's what sponsors are for. The program is the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Unfortunately, guys like me do very poorly at taking the book and going off in a corner and doing it myself, so I need some guidance. I need some guidance from somebody who's had some experience doing that stuff. And here was somebody who had been sober, had a sponsor himself who had read the book Alcoholics Anonymous and practiced that stuff in his life, who had shown him how to do that, and here he was passing that on to me. And here was also somebody, you know, another quality that I really like in my sponsor was he has such a tremendous amount of respect for the people who had passed the stuff down on to him, and he was so concerned about passing the same program on to me that was passed on to him. And it's something that's, I hope, rubbed off on me, that same respect and desire not to muddle the thing up, which is great that we have a book, because that helps with that a great deal. So he showed me how to take the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. That was the first thing. The second thing he did for me, which I think is maybe equally important in a sponsor, because there are a lot of people who have taken steps and you can ask anybody how to take a step. They don't have to be your sponsor. He showed me how to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he did things to me, with me and for me, like brought me to meetings, suggested that I go to some of the same meetings that he went to. And he would do things like if I would say crazy things or act out in a meeting or do something weird, he would let me know about it. He'd say, this is what we do here. And his whole attitude about this stuff was like, look, this is all I have. I have the program. I have the steps. I have Alcoholics Anonymous. It's all I have. Everything that I have is available to you if you want it, but you don't have to have it. And he never talked down to me. Or did anything like that, and there was never asked anything of me except to go out and work with others. And what I try to do as a sponsor is, what I try to do as a sponsee is continue to be open to accepting and receiving the help that is offered me, which is a very, very difficult thing to do. And what I try to do as a sponsor is emulate my sponsor, who I have a tremendous amount of respect and a debt of gratitude for, but do it by being myself. Because I could hear it from him, and not everybody can hear it from him. And so I need to be myself so that the people who can hear it from me can hear it from me. And the guys that I sponsor, some of those guys have sponsees that would never hear it from me. And that's the way this thing gets passed on. And I think my time is up, and I thank you very much for having me.
And our second speaker is Ann.
My name's Ann. I'm an alcoholic. Hey, everybody. Thank you, Gary, very much. And thank you, David, for asking me to do this. I wasn't nervous until Gary was like 5 minutes into his, you know. That's not true. I was nervous before Gary sat up. But anyway, I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's why I'm willing to do this. David asked me to talk about home group, and I do have a home group, and I love that home group. And I could look out in the room tonight, and I know a lot of people from that group. And there are people here, that's the three people that started that meeting. And I am so grateful for that, because when I moved to Portland, I was floundering a little bit. And I got a group right away that I called a home group, but of course I'd call and complain about it every week to my sponsor, and he didn't really care, and I continued to do the things that I was supposed to do, but the group that I belong to now really talks the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I am so grateful for that. You know, it speaks my language, and I really thank you guys for that. I just really do, and I'll be forever indebted. So, you know, I've always had a home group since I got sober. I didn't know it. I didn't know that that was a home group. And welcome to those who are new, and just what I've been taught what a home group is where I go on a regular basis, and I give the most of my time and the most of my money and the most of me. And I get to know those people, and I let them get to know me. And for an alcoholic, for me, that's hard. I can get to know you, and I know what's going on in your life, but I'm like this. You know, you could know this much of me, and it's all going to be good. You know, what I want you to know, and that's it. And when I show up to the same place week in and week out, you know, and I'm doing like Gary talked about, it's a package deal, and that chink starts to happen in that armor, I let you guys in. And when I let you guys in, my life explodes, you know. And I learned that at a home group. Like I said, I've always practiced that. I didn't know that. You know, I've had home groups where... I forgot that I had a commitment there, you know. They didn't, but I did. And, you know, and so I wasn't the greatest member all the time until I was about, I don't mean now I'm the greatest member, until now. When I was eight years sober, I switched sponsors, and that sponsor, at that time, he had the same home group for 17 years, and the only reason he changed is because he moved. And I really began to see what a home group is and what I get to learn from a home group and how I get to grow up because of a home group. You know, first and foremost, I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I can't, my home group can't be something outside of that. It's a part of that deal. But the way I show respect to Alcoholics Anonymous is by having that home group and having a voice there and listening to other people's voices. I didn't know, I listened to the ones in my head, but I never actually like listened to other people's opinions. And, you know, and had that, those where it talks about in the traditions, the my clamors and desires have to be squashed for the good of the group. When I started getting to know those people, that, you know, that group became more important than I am. And that's huge for me, because I was always the biggest deal in my own head. And when I could be in my home group, it's more important how that is going to function as a meeting that carries the message of how I don't have to drink today. Because that's what this is about. The people who are new are probably thinking, I don't care what a home group is. I don't even like this meeting. You know, I just don't want to drink today. And that's fine. And welcome to you all. I didn't like any meeting when I got new, and I didn't like anybody. And, you know, but... Because I was desperate, like it was mentioned, I showed up in spite of myself and started doing the package. And I hope you guys do too. because what I've been given here is far beyond what I deserve and far beyond my wildest dreams, and that doesn't escape me. So, but like I said, I was 8 years sober, and I watched how this man conducted himself, and, you know, just he had this tremendous thing happen in his life, and he shares this story, and he called up his sponsor and, you know, was sad and complaining, you know, blah, 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 and his sponsor said, okay, well, tonight's your home group night. And he said, yeah, it is. And he said, well, you go sit in your chair. And so that's what he did, and because of that, you know, two people asked him to sponsor him, and then later on that week, I asked him to sponsor me, and I'm sharing his part because that was so important to me, because it doesn't matter what's going on in my life, I have to show up there, because if I don't show up and tell you what's going on in my life, it's going to become a bigger deal than it needs to be, because that's what I always have done. I'm a bigger deal than I need to be all the time, and in my home group, that gets to be squashed for a little while. I get to be a part of something, and that is amazing for me, and I still fight with that. You know, we have business meetings on a regular basis at my group, and I really just want to hand out an agenda and say, this is what we'll be doing for the next year. Now let's, time's up, you know, because I think I know. And then I'll listen, and somebody will say their opinion about something, and I'll think, God, I never saw it that way, you know. And because I've been, you know, my ego's been crushed enough, I can actually sometimes hear somebody else's point of view, you know, and admit to it and maybe even change my behavior. That took me a long time. Somebody might tell me their opinion, and I might think you're right, but I'm going to die over my, you know, I'm going to die before I tell you you're right. And I was dying. And you know, and I love that I get to be a small part of a great whole. And again, I get to show that appreciation by showing up and being of service. Everything I know, I've learned in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, how to just give something for the sake of giving it, you know, how to be on time and be responsible and be accountable. Those are things that I've learned from people like you and showing up at the same place, because I didn't want you to get to know me, and I was just going to be here and there. And I had no accountability. And today I have accountability to that group, and I love it. And it's taught me how to be mature and, you know, just, like I said, smash that ego. And the people in that group, you know, they know me. And I went through the worst thing that I ever had to go through in my life, and this is my experience of Alcoholics Anonymous and what a meeting is for, and this is the importance of a home group altogether. I had to go through an awful experience for me, and I didn't have to share it at group level to unburden myself, you know. I'm sorry if other people do that. I mean no offense. But, and I don't think most people, I mean, I really don't. I don't, I mean, it works for people, but I know for me, because that was my home group, those people knew what was going on with me, and they carried me through that time. And because I had commitments, and that group was more important than what was going on inside my head, I didn't have to wallow in self-pity. I showed up anyway, and I watch you people do that all the time. I get to know what's going on in your life and watch you guys show up in spite of it with grace and dignity and carry the message, because it's more important that somebody doesn't drink today than what's going on in my life. And I learned that from a home group, and I hope you all get one and that you participate in it. Thank you.
And now tonight, our main speaker is David.
My name's Dave. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Dave.
Thank you, Rick, very much for asking me to do this. Thank you both very much for speaking. Happy birthday to all the birthday people. Welcome to all the people who are new. Whether you believe it or not, you're the reason why we're here. I have a sobriety date. It's December 12th of 1996. I do have a home group, and I do have a sponsor today, and those are three things that that I've had since I've been here. And that was not always the case. I'm one of those people that came to Alcoholics Anonymous and was here for several years, showed up on a regular basis, and did not get those things. And did not stay sober until I started to participate and do the things that you guys talked about. And what happened for me was, you know, if you're new, you know, Gary talked about this deal being the last house on the block or being that last option. If you're new, I hope that's the case for you, because that was absolutely the case for me when I got here. And, you know, it our book mentions it several times, and for me it was, you know, I'd gotten to the point to where there was nowhere else for me to go. And, you know, I started to, when that happened, that's when I think my ears opened up and I started to listen to what you guys were really saying. And I started to not only listen to the way that you guys drank, but I also listened to the things that you guys talked about that went on in your head. And those are the things that I started to really relate to and hang on to when I first got here. And, you know, I grew up, in Atlanta, Georgia, and I lived there till I was 16 years old, and I was 25 when I got sober. And so I grew up there and was from the outside a very normal kid. You know, I was very active in school and sports and had friends and all that sort of stuff. But I was just a very, very uncomfortable kid. You know, I always, for whatever reason, no matter what was going on in my life, I always just felt a little, and I hear it here all the time, a little different than or apart from or whatever it was. I just, for whatever reason, no matter how much stuff was going on in my life, I always felt alone. And so when I started drinking at the age of 14, 15 years old, I started drinking. And it was my solution. You know, I heard that when I first got here. There's a very good friend of mine that talks about, a lot of people do, but he was the first person I heard say it. You know, he talked about alcohol being his solution before he got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was absolutely the case for me. When I started drinking, all of those things went away. You know, it just, at least temporarily, you know, I didn't care as much anymore about all that stuff. And then I moved from, which I was very unhappy about, I moved from Atlanta to California, to the Bay Area, which is very different. And when you're 16 and you're already not feeling like you fit in, you know, I remember my sophomore year going to that high school, you know, again, from the outside, I got involved right away as far as, you know, I got active in sports in this school right away and with people and friends and stuff. But to me, I still felt like there was something missing. And I had a pretty strong accent at the time. I don't have it anymore. But so I first started going to the school, and I would say things like, this was like the first week or so, I'd say things like, "So what are y'all fixing to do?" And the problem with that was, as soon as I would say it, it would be said right back to me, and they would mimic everything that I said, and I thought that was terribly cruel. So I immediately just started to talk like they do and started to fit in and do the things that they do. And you know, it's that chameleon that we hear about here. You know, I try to fit the group that I'm in. And you know, I just immediately found people that like to drink like I do, and I was one of those people very early on. I'm an isolator, and I'm an isolated drinker. I prefer to drink by myself. If there were other people there, that was okay. But once that effect started to happen for me, once that feeling started to kick in, I would have some sort of excuse on why I had to leave. And that happened about 17 years old, when I just kind of retreated to my own little whatever. And at that time too, it wasn't a conscious decision I made, but I started drinking on a daily basis at that time. You know, from the time I was 16 years old, people were telling me that I was an alcoholic, which is not really a good sign. But they were. You know, people were telling me that all the time. My friends were telling me that. My friends that I was drinking with at the time were telling me that I was an alcoholic. And I had a doctor when I was 19 one time tell me that I was an alcoholic. I didn't know that he was in AA, but he pointed that out to me as well. And, you know, I made my first attempt at you know, trying to change the situation or to move around a little bit, and I moved from the Bay Area up to Chico, California, and lived there for about a year. And that was my first attempt to stop drinking, and which Chico is known for a big drinking school. It's probably one of the biggest drinking schools in California. So that didn't work out very well. And it's funny, the first several years I was actually in AA, I actually said that I actually moved up there and went to Chico. I couldn't get into Chico. I would go, which is sad. And I went to, there was a community college in Oroville, California, called Butte Community College that I flunked out of and then left Chico. So I was there for a period of time, and things just continued to get worse, and that was the first point in my life where I really started to see where alcohol was affecting my life. And my roommates were disgusted by me. Anybody that knew me, that for whatever reason they were disgusted by me, mainly because I drank by myself, and for whatever reason they didn't see that as social drinking. They just saw that as some sort of problem. And I made my second to last attempt when I was 20 or 21. I moved down to San Diego, and for the same reason, I moved down there so I could maybe get my life back together, enroll in school, and just do something different. I figured San Diego had to be a lot different than, I didn't know anybody down there, but I just figured it had to be a lot different. So I moved down there, and I was renting a room. I rented a room from these two girls lived in this house, and I rented a room from one of the girls who owned the house, and enrolled in San Diego State, and attempted to go there, and that didn't really pan out either. And I'm just isolating more and more. And this right off the bat, this particularly the girl that owned the house, the other girl that lived there, she didn't really care, but the girl that owned the house saw that I was not necessarily a normal roommate. You know, the fact that I was just constantly, number one, I was constantly drinking, and I was constantly drinking in my room, and I was just drunk all the time. And she didn't, she wasn't a big fan of that. And the first couple of weeks the first couple of months I was there, I moved in the summer of whatever it was. And Thanksgiving of that year, the two of them went up to L.A. for a couple of weeks for Thanksgiving to visit with their families. And they're up there for 2 weeks. The day that they're gone, I'm wandering around San Diego. I'm wandering around this parking lot. And there's this girl screaming about the fact that there's this chicken loose running around this parking lot. And so I come over to help, and I see this thing running in and out underneath the cars, you know, in the middle of this parking lot. And so I start chasing this thing around the parking lot. And to this day, I have no idea how this happened, but I was able to catch the chicken, and I went over to her, and because I assumed it was hers, because she was very upset about it, and I went over and I said, "Here you go," and she said, "It's not mine." So I put it in my car, and I took this thing home. So what I did for the next couple of weeks was I just let this thing run around inside this house. And this was not, I mean, this was just like a regular house. It was not, you know, there was no backyard, there was no farm or anything like that. It was just a house. And so I let this thing run around inside the house. And what I would do was I had this car that I used to wreck a lot. And fortunately, I never hit other people. I just always hit, like, you know, like the guide rail and the center rails and all that sort of stuff. So both front ends were smashed, both back ends were smashed. And I would fix it all myself. What I would do is I would take a hammer and a screwdriver, and I would punch all these holes in the front and the back, and I would just pull them all out, pull all the dents out. And then I would just leave it like that. So every time I would go somewhere, I had one of the plastic milk crates, like the one we use for the literature here. I would put her in that, and I would take her and I'd put her in the front seat, and I would drive around. And what would happen was I would pull up to stoplights, and these, about probably 6 months ago, somebody said, "Have you ever thought of taking that carton and turn it upside down, and the chicken would stay in there?" Because what this thing would do is it would attack, and it was bouncing off the windshield, and it was attacking me, and you know, I'm bleeding, and there's feathers flying everywhere. So I remember I would pull up to stoplights, and people would look over, and they would see this car just covered with holes, and you know, feathers flying everywhere, and this chicken, and I saw absolutely nothing wrong with that. You know, still to this day, it's not that funny of a story to me. So what would happen was, I would drive around with this thing, and then I would take her home, and we'd sit there and hang out or whatever. But I wouldn't feed her or anything. So what she did to survive for that 2 weeks was she would go around the house and she would eat all of the houseplants. There was one night that I was sitting there, I'm sitting there, and I always went through phases in my drinking, and this was my tequila phase. I just drank tequila out of pint glasses. So I remember sitting there one night late, and I've got her right here. I'm holding her, and then I've got my pint glass of tequila. And I'm sitting there, and the thought crosses my mind that I'm probably a loser. which is not good. So the roommates come home, and the one that didn't own the house, she thought it was mildly amusing. The one that owned the house, she came in, all of her house plants are eaten. There's feathers all over the place. There's fleas all over the place. This chicken went to the bathroom throughout the entire house for 2 straight weeks, and it was bad. So she, immediately kicked us out, and I found a. So we left, and she was very adamant about just throwing that thing out the front door, which I was not going to do at this point. So I called a bunch of places and found a place that would take her, but. So that was kind of the very beginning of when I started to spiral down. I was 21 at the time, and that's when I first got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. Very shortly after that, I ended up in a psychiatric hospital at the suggestion of several people. And we would go to AA meetings. And at the time, I absolutely loved it. I was in this hospital. It was not a treatment center. They just put everybody together. So it would be the alcoholics and the drug addicts and the schizophrenics and the people that were manic depressive and the people that were suicidal. There were people that had lived there for 8, 9, 10 years and that were never going to leave. And I absolutely loved it. It was not a place where there was no bus that'd take you out. I mean, you were not leaving. So AA meetings would come into you, and, we'd have AA meetings come in, as my first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had all these people coming in and it was the only time at night that we would all split up. I thought all those things that people think when they get here, and they're not ready. I thought of all the things that made me different than all of you people, whether it was my age or whatever it was. I separated myself from you people, even though at the time this was the most comfortable place I'd ever been in. At the time, it was the most comfortable I'd ever been around other people. But I didn't see that at the time. So I left there. I stayed sober for like a month or so. I met this girl named Miracle. And she, which was her real name. And started hanging out with her. And she happened to be, she was an AA too. She also happened to be a big fan of Speedballs at the time. So we pretty much can assume what happens there. But we started hanging out for the next few years, and we did not make a very good pair. But one thing that we did was we constantly went to, both of us, for that first year or so, we would go to meetings on a nightly basis. I was sober during none of that time. After that time, I left that hospital. I just continued to stay low until I was 25 when I got sober. What happened was I was living in this place, and my days just started to all kind of blur together, and they all just kind of became exactly the same. What would happen was I'd get up around 6:30 in the morning, sick. I would hang out at gas stations and bus stops asking people for money, and I would always have this story about how I was, what people that were dressed like I am now, they're going to work. This is in California, so you're pumping your own gas. While you're doing that, you have me coming up and explaining to you that I'm a college student and I have a job and I don't get paid till Friday and blah, blah, blah. And you could look at me and tell that neither one of those things were true. I just had given up at this point. I just my daily routine was exactly the same. I would shower maybe at best once a month. I would change my clothes at best once a month. And this apartment that I was living in the last couple of years was completely empty. And I used to sleep underneath the, sometimes the electricity was on, sometimes it wasn't. And I used to sleep, if the electricity was on, I would sleep because I would get real sick during the night. I'd sleep right underneath the air conditioner. And if the electricity wasn't hooked up for whatever period of time, then I would open the door and I would sleep out by the balcony. And I didn't have any plates. I had sold all my plates. So what I did was I was stealing newspapers from all my neighbors, and the entire floor was of this apartment was covered with newspapers. And I used to eat off of these newspapers, so there was like remnants of food and all this stuff. And that's the way I lived. I lived like literally like an animal for those last few years, and at the time didn't think anything of that either. I would just get up, and that was my life, and that was my day. And at the end of the day, I went to my regular AA meeting, and it was exactly the same. What happened was through a series of events, I ended up back up in Northern California, and I was going to meetings up there. I got involved in this men's group. I went through another hospital at that point, and I got involved in this men's group prior to me getting sober that I was going to on a regular basis down in Walnut Creek area, and I would show up there every Monday and every Wednesday night, which was the night that this group met. And these guys would say things like, you better get a God in your life or you're going to die. And then they would just walk away. Or they would just walk up to me and say something like, you know, when are you going to do something different? They just saw me show up night in and night out, and these same guys would see me at other meetings, and it was the same every single day. I sat in the back, I didn't talk to anybody, and I left when the meeting was over. So what happened was, what happens to a lot of us is, you know, I started to worry about the fact that this was going to kill me. And I think what happened to me even worse was I kind of crossed that line from being afraid of dying to afraid of not dying. And I thought, you know, there's a friend of mine that talks about that last day that he was drinking, if he had a crystal ball and he saw that if he just hung in there and continued for 30 more days, it would all be over, he would have kept on. That was absolutely the case for me. If I knew that I could just continue on for 30 more days, it would all be over. But I didn't know that was the case. And I physically and mentally could not do it anymore. So on December 11th of 96, the last day that I drank, I went to my regular Wednesday night meeting in Walnut Creek. That was my home group for the first 3 years until I moved up here. That I was sober, and there's a guy that had 12-stepped me about a year and a half prior to that. And I had known this guy, and this guy's name was Hippie Rick, and I had asked this guy to be my sponsor on more than one occasion, but I asked him again that night. And he knew me, and I related to this guy. I knew that I was like this guy. And what was so important for me for that identification, that relating to somebody else's story, is I'm not going to follow the directions that you suggest or the things that you do until I know that I'm somewhat like you. And that's why it was so important that I knew that there was a part of me that was like this guy. Not only that I drank like this guy, because I knew that that was the case for a long time, but I knew that my head thought the same way that his did. And this guy got me involved very early on. I was going to a lot of meetings. I was going to probably 15, 17 meetings a week at that time. And, you know, I got jobs at meetings, and I was going to big book studies and 12 and 12s, and I was going to this guy's house and taking the steps with this guy. And he had me call him at 6:30 every single morning. And he was the kind of guy that, he only had a few years at the time, but he had a few years at the time. He was the kind of guy that if I called him at 6:40, he'd say, call me tomorrow on time, and he'd hang up on me. And the thing that was interesting about that was he didn't sponsor anybody else like that. And that was not necessarily the norm of that group, but hanging up on people, that is. But this guy knew that, you know, I believe God puts people in our lives that we can hear. And for whatever reason, that type of message was the only way that I was going to hear it. And this guy explained to me why he was doing that. You know, I had never been responsible or or, you know, responsible to anybody at that point. And he talked to me about how he was setting aside time every day at his work to spend time with me and go through the book and teach me about Alcoholics Anonymous and teach me how he takes the steps. And by me continuing just to call whenever I wanted to was just me staying in that selfishness and self-centeredness. So I started to follow simple directions like calling this guy on time. And this guy worked early in the morning, and then he would get off work and he'd be home about 1:30 or so, and then I would show up at his house at 2 a couple times a week and start going through the book. And this guy, his nickname was Hippie Rick. He had this long ponytail, and I showed up at his house at 2. He had an 8-year-old kid that would be home from school at 3:30, which meant at 3:30 I had to go. Not because he wanted me to go, but because I was too afraid of other human beings, that when his 8-year-old son, which he still thinks this is funny to this day, when his 8-year-old son would walk in the room, I would have to leave because I was too afraid of other people, period. Even this 8-year-old kid. So this guy, Hippie Rick, we're sitting there and we're going through the book, and we just started at page 1 and we just read it, and when we got to a step, we took it. And we read literally sentence by sentence and paragraph by paragraph, and he would explain it to me. And what was difficult about this at the time was, and I just thought about this the other day, I saw him when I was back down in the Bay Area a couple weeks ago, was this guy had the long ponytail, he had the big black leather jacket, and I'm sitting there on his couch, holding the book, and we're reading through the book, and he's pacing back and forth in his living room. And he's pacing, and this guy's kind of a yeller. So he's like, reading and yelling and reading and yelling, and the whole time he's got Frank Zappa blaring in the background. which is distracting to begin. I mean, this is distracting already, and then, all the other stuff going on made it very difficult. But what this guy did was he taught me how he lived his life, and he taught me how he lived his life outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's one thing that that's been so key to every home group that particularly that group and the groups I've been involved in since, which would be every home group. Those guys have brought me into their lives outside of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I see how they are with their families, and I see how they are at the workplace, and I see how they are with people that they don't know that they just run into out in the general public, and I see how they treat people. And one of the things that this guy would hammer into me very early on was he said, there's that part in the ninth step promises in the big book that people read after some meetings. And there's that part that says, and this was not a cruel statement, it was just a fact. He said there's that part that says that uselessness, that feeling of uselessness, he said, that's not a feeling for you, that's a fact. And that was absolutely true for me. I had been living off of other people for a long period of time, and I had not been of any value to anybody else. And he said that, and in our books, one thing I love about our book is it repeats itself over and over and over again. And he said for him, that what has to happen is he has to go from that feeling of uselessness, that action of uselessness, to having a life full of useful purpose. Not because he wanted to, or not because, it was the right thing to do, or not because it was even the nice thing to do, but because his life depended upon it. And that's what's important for me, is I have to remember that, doing all these things, I can dress it up and say, whatever I want to about it, but my life depends upon me doing this stuff, and my life depends upon me getting out of myself and being of some value to others, to somebody else. And so this guy would as we continued to go through the book and we continued to go through the steps, this guy started to teach me about God. And the guys in this home group started to teach me about God as well. And I spent a lot of time outside of AA meetings with this guy at his house. And that first year, I'm one of those guys, for me it got worse before it got better. And that was just the case for me. It was, that first year was very difficult. And I had a very difficult time talking to other people. And if I knew you or if I saw you, the one question I knew to ask people, because I thought this is what people asked, was I asked what you do for a living. What is your job? And which I asked the first 5 times I think I met my wife. I think I asked her where she worked. The problem with that is once you answered that question, I was done. I was out of questions. That was just the one question I knew that I figured that's how I didn't know how to talk to other people. Maybe that's what people say to people. So the other problem that was the next time I saw you, which might have been the next night, I asked you again where your job, you know, what you did for a living, hoping maybe you changed jobs or something. But it was just difficult, you know, that those basic things of just learning how to interact with other people. And what started to, and the reason why I continued to do this stuff rather than just to stay in that isolation was my life depended upon it. You know, he told me to call other people all the time, and I would call them, and I would say, Hippie Rick's my sponsor, he told me to call people. And that's it, that's all I'd say. And then they would talk for, you know, 5 or 10 minutes, because they knew why I was calling. You know, they knew I was just picking up the phone and dialing and calling somebody in AA. That's the only thing I was doing. I had nothing to say, I had nothing to offer. I was just practicing that action of calling other people. And as we started to work through the steps, and this guy started to teach me about God. And when I got to that fourth step, and I started to look at, look at all those defects of character and those fears and all those things that had basically run my life and had paralyzed me my whole life, I started to see that whole time, you know, back when I was drinking and I had no idea what was wrong with me, I didn't know what my problem was, and I would sit in those AA meetings and I would desperately want to be like you people. I would sit there every single night and think, tomorrow I'm going to do things different. And what happened was every single day I woke up the next day and I thought, maybe if I, you know, get a few dollars, get a few drinks in me, then maybe I could get a job and I could blah, blah, blah. And that never happened during that time. You know, once I started to put physical sobriety first, that's when I could listen to you people and start to follow those directions. So I started to learn about that in the fourth step, and I started to go through the steps. And the big turning point for me was I was probably about 8 or 9 months sober, and I started to go out and make amends to people, which was my least favorite part in the beginning to do in the steps. I was somebody who was so terrified of other people. The idea of going up to other people and going through this stuff was horrifying. But it was by far the most rewarding for me. I think that's where I saw, that's when I actually believed that Alcoholics Anonymous could work for somebody like me. And I think that's when I actually believed that I could, that somebody like me could have a relationship with a God of my own understanding, a God that I can do business with, that can help me recover from this disease. And I was a year sober, and this kid, I call him a kid because he was only 15 years old at the time, he asked me to sponsor him. And, which I didn't know what to do. You know, I went up to my sponsor and he said, well, you say yes, and then you just do all the stuff that I did with you. So I took this guy around to the meetings that I went to, and I introduced him to the people that I knew, and I told him to call these people, and it's just that same cycle, you know, of showing people the things that were shown to me. And when we moved up here, I was 3 years sober at the time, and it was just like starting over again. You know, I mean, it was just like starting over. And anybody who's moved in Alcoholics Anonymous and sobriety knows that it's not, at least from my experience, it's not terribly easy. But we weren't even unpacked yet, and I think that second night or something, and we went to an AA meeting and just started to get involved from the very beginning. And what has happened over that period of time, I'm going to speed up because I've been talking for a long time, my life has continued to get better. And the only reason why it's continued to get better is because I've followed people around here. It's absolutely nothing that I've done. You know, I just continue to try to develop that relationship with God through my, the book refers to it as self-sacrifice. That's how we get our spiritual growth. It says it over and over and over again, that our spiritual growth is tied to our self-sacrifice to others. And for me, that means whether I want to or whether I don't. You know, I have to continue to be of value, and I also don't get to pick and choose. You know, where I'm supposed to help, I don't get to pick and choose what it is I want to do. And there's a friend of mine down in the Bay Area that he got sober a few years before I did. But whenever we talk on the phone, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. There's absolutely nothing that I wouldn't do for this thing. And he feels the same way I do. And we talk about this all the time. And we always talk about, you know, what has happened to us and how that, you know, we don't deserve this and the things that have gone in our life as a result of literally just following people around and watching what they do and doing the things that they do. And, you know, for me, that's just, You know, there's nothing I could do to pay any of that back. You know, I mean, my life's very different today than it was then. You know, I mean, you know, I'm today at 6, rather than, you know, the bus stops and the gas station, that whole thing, today at 6:30, I'm sitting there watching, you know, Sesame Street and with my son, you know, Elmo and the whole thing. I'm sitting there, and it just, and I'm, and I would talk to this guy down in the Bay Area, and we talk about how different that is, you know, and what a different, you know, what a difference that has happened in our lives as far as simple things, just like learning responsibility. You know, there's so much more going on in my life today that that it's overwhelming at times, and it's absolutely unbelievable. It's a wonderful life. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you very much.